The Other Gospels by Nick Perrin, Robert C. Newman. We're going to have a look at some of the other Gospels outside the New Testament in light of Dan Brown's claims in the Da Vinci Code. On page 231 of the hardback edition of the Da Vinci Code, the fellow that is represented as the ex-royal historian of Britain makes this claim. More than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, yet only a relatively few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them. The question we want to consider is, were there really 80 Gospels considered for the New Testament? There is good early evidence for the four Gospels. We find that in the writings of Irenaeus about 180, Justin Martyr about 150, some allusions in the longer ending of Mark even earlier, and Papias about 125. There's no suggestion that other Gospels were ever considered seriously for inclusion in the canon. As I point out in my canon discussions, only the Gospel of Hebrews ever makes it up even into the category of considered by some. So that's where we are. Well, some of the other Gospels that are around over the centuries. Hugh, put a question mark after that. We'll see why in a moment. Gospel of Thomas. Gospel of Peter. Gospel of Philip. Gospel of the Ebionites. Gospel according to the Hebrews. Gospel of Mary. And some others. Nothing close to 80, perhaps 20 or 30 in all. Dan Brown claims that the earliest Christian records are the Nag Hammadi and Dead Sea Scrolls, and troublingly, they do not match up with the Gospels of the Bible. He says this on page 245, 246 of the hardback edition of the Da Vinci Code. So that raises another question to consider. Are the Nag Hammadi and Dead Sea texts really the earliest Christian records? Let's look at that first, and then we'll come back on the other. The Dead Sea Scrolls consist of a number of moderately complete scrolls and thousands of fragments discovered around 1948 and in the years thereafter in Palestine. The oldest of these come from about 250 B.C., but most of them come from the first century B.C., that is, after 100 and before the turn of the era. Nearly all of these predate Christianity, and in fact, they are not Christian, they are Jewish. The Nag Hammadi papyri are 52 texts written on papyrus and bound in 12 booklets or codices found in the Egyptian desert about 1945. These are all written in Coptic and date to the 4th century A.D., that is, the writing of these particular documents. They contain four works that are entitled Gospel. These four Nag Hammadi Gospels are the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of the Egyptians, and the Gospel of Truth. We'll say something about the first two of these. The fourth one is actually more of a treatise and doesn't take anything like what we'd think of as a gospel form. How do we decide when these particular works were written? How do we date, for instance, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, and Q? In spite of the picture I've got there, by dating them, we don't really mean assign a month or day on which they were written, but try and make some approximation of around the year in which they might have been written. So how do we date the Gospel of Philip, for instance? Well, one thing we do is we look and see if a writing quotes other writings or not, and the Gospel of Philip cites Paul's letters and the Gospel of John, so that puts it after about 100 A.D. When the theology of the Gospel of Philip is analyzed, we find out it follows the theology of Valentinus, one of the Gnostic gurus, and that would suggest 140 to 160 or even later for its date. Our copy of the Gospel of Philip is in Coptic, but various remarks in the text and remarks about words and such show a Syrian background to it. So it appears to be later 2nd century A.D. at the earliest. Bart Ehrman, a New Testament scholar who is by no means conservative, dates the Gospel of Philip at around 250 A.D., so middle of the 3rd century. How do we date the Gospel of Thomas? This is, as Nick says, the foundational building block of the Jesus Seminar. That is, this is the reason why they try to argue is equally old with the four Gospels of the New Testament, etc. Well, it contains 114 sayings, and about half of these are from our four Gospels, which suggests but do not prove that Thomas was written after the Gospels. More seriously, it appears to quote Paul in Revelation, suggesting it is after AD 100. Elaine Poggles, who has written on the Gnosticism, dates it earlier and tries to put it in the 1st century AD, as a few other scholars do as well. But the most widely accepted date is around 140 AD. Our co-author here, Nick Perrin, dates it as late as the late 2nd century AD, and that's based on his doctoral thesis at Marquette University, I believe that is, where he shows that there is very good evidence that the Gospel of Thomas depends upon the Diatessaron of Tatian, which we think was written around 175 A.D., so late 2nd century A.D. Thirdly, how do we date Q? This is used by Matthew and Luke, so that would put it in the mid-1st century A.D., but we need to hold it for a minute, because we need to ask the question, what is meant by Q, and did Q ever really exist? Well, what is meant by Q? Well, this diagram over here on the right is the diagram of what we call the two-document model, or two-document hypothesis of the origin of the three synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And Q is a hypothetical document that is proposed to explain certain similarities between Matthew and Luke in material they have that doesn't overlap with Mark. And so it explains these similarities on the assumption that they used Mark as one of their sources and used another written source to compose their Gospels. And if they did, then that source would look something like the hypothesized Q. But did Q ever really exist? This is currently disputed. Certainly it hasn't been more than about 30 years or so when virtually the entire New Testament community, scholarly community, thought that Q did exist, but that consensus has dropped away some in recent years. No document corresponding to Q has ever been found, and that was true 30 years ago. The proponents claim it would look something like Thomas, that is, it would be sayings of Jesus or something like that, or at least discourses of Jesus. No reference to Q from antiquity has ever been found. Obviously, we wouldn't expect them to call it Q, that's a modern name, though some claim that Papias' reference to Matthew's Logia is really about Q rather than about the Gospel of Matthew. Certainly the other early church fathers did not think so. They understood Papias to be talking about Matthew, and it doesn't look like that even all of them were dependent upon Papias, but seem to have independent evidence that Matthew's Logia was in fact the Gospel of Matthew. So, dating these documents, Q, Thomas, Peter, Philip, Ebionites, Hebrews, Gospel of Mary, Mary Magdalene. Q, dated around 50, if it existed. Thomas, three rather divergent dates, 50, 140, 175, with really the best evidence for the 175. Gospel of Peter, about 150. Philip, 175 to 250. Ebionites, about 150. Hebrews, Gospel of the Hebrews, about 150, and the Gospel of Mary, or Gospel of Mary Magdalene, about 175. Well, let's continue with some of Brown's claims. Brown says, these are the Nag Hammadi and the Dead Sea Scrolls, the earliest Christian records. Troublingly, they do not match up with the Gospels in the Bible. Well, we pointed out that the Dead Sea Scrolls certainly are not the earliest Christian records. Nag Hammadi certainly is Christian in some broad sense, where Gnosticism is included under Christianity, and we'll have to deal with this other question, is it true that these records do not match up with the Gospels in the Bible? Brown goes on to claim, page 234, fortunately for historians, some of the Gospels that Constantine attempted to eradicate managed to survive. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the 1950s hidden in a cave near Qumran in the Judean Desert, and of course the Coptic Scrolls in 1945 at Nag Hammadi. In addition to telling the true Grail story, these documents speak of Christ's ministry in very human terms. He says also on that page, the scrolls highlight glaring historical discrepancies and fabrications, clearly confirming that the modern Bible was compiled and edited by men who possessed a political agenda to promote the divinity of the man Jesus and use his influence to solidify their own power base. Later on, he says, page 244, the early church needed to convince the world that a mortal prophet Jesus was a divine being. Therefore, any gospels that describe earthly aspects of Jesus' life had to be omitted from the Bible. So, questions to consider, do the Nag Hammadi and or other non-canonical accounts of Jesus really emphasize the humanity of Jesus? Well, first of all, think about the gospels in our New Testament, the canonical gospels. The canonical gospels actually emphasize Jesus' humanity and usually only hint at his deity. The alleged Q document provides no evidence of a different Jesus than the one seen in these Gospels. Elsewhere on our IBRI website, I, Bob Newman, have a paper on the Q document and its testimony regarding Jesus, and it definitely comes down in this regard, that Jesus is pictured as human and is more than human in the Q document, if the Q document even exists, but the materials that are alleged to have been in the Q document, which actually are in Luke and Matthew. What do the Gnostic Gospels tell us about Jesus? Well, Jesus in the Gospel of Philip. For he, referring to Jesus in the context, showed himself not to be as he really was, but he appeared in a way that they could see him. To those he appeared to the great as great, he appeared to the small as small, he appeared to the angels as an angel, and to humans as a human. Gospel of Philip, chapter 26. So in Philip, Jesus only appeared to be human. In the Gospel of Peter, others standing there were spitting in his face, referring to Jesus. Some slapped his cheeks, others were beating him with reeds, some began to flog him, saying, "This is how we should honor the Son of God." They brought forward two evildoers and crucified the Lord between them, but he was silent as if he had no pain. It looks like the Gospel of Peter here is suggested as that Jesus is suffering no pain. That suggests that the Gospel of Peter is at least Docetist, if not Gnostic. Docetism is a remark on Docetism from the Evangelical Dictionary of Theology. Docetism is a term used to refer to a theological perspective among some in the early church who regarded the sufferings and the human aspects of Christ as imaginary or apparent, rather than, instead of being part of a real incarnation. The basic thesis of such docetics was that if Christ suffered, he was not divine, and if he was God, he could not suffer. While the framers, the apostles, and Nicene creeds were opposed to ascetic teaching and clearly assumed the two natures of Jesus, the drafters of the definition of Chalcedon, 451 A.D., made explicit the Christian teaching concerning Jesus Christ as truly God and truly man. So the picture here is that in the Gospel of Peter, you apparently have Jesus pictured as feeling no pain, but the Orthodox view was that Jesus was really human, and so he got tired, he got hungry, he felt pain, and he died, even though he was also God. So human aspects, sufferings of Christ as imaginary or apparent is the docetic picture there. So Brown has got it backwards. The biblical Gospels emphasize Jesus' human traits more than the Gnostic Gospels do. Brown goes on to claim about Mary Magdalene. Unfortunately for the early editors, he says on page 244, one particularly troubling earthly theme kept recurring in the Gospels. Mary Magdalene, more specifically her marriage to Jesus Christ. And then Keating, that's the British historian, retired British historian, Keating pointed to a passage, the Gospel of Philip is always a good place to start. Sophie read the passage. And the companion of the Savior is Mary Magdalene. Christ loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on her mouth. The rest of the disciples were offended by it and expressed disapproval. They said to him, "Why do you love her more than all of us?" The word surprised Sophie, and yet they hardly seem conclusive. It says nothing of marriage. Au contraire, Teabing smiled, pointing to the first line, as any Aramaic scholar will tell you, the word companion in those days literally meant spouse. Langton concurred with a nod. Sophie read the first line again. "And the companion of the Savior is Mary Magdalene." Jesus and Mary in the Gospel of Philip. There were three Marys who walked with the Lord all the time: his mother, his sister, and Magdalene, the one who was called his partner, Koinonos. For his sister and his mother and his associate, Chotra, are Marys. Gospel of Philip, chapter 32. The Coptic terms here, this is in Coptic, not in Aramaic, the Coptic terms partner, associate, are primarily business and religious terms, respectively. While it's possible for either term to mean spouse, these usages are rare. The meaning of the Coptic terms, koinonos, business partner, spiritual partner, co-participant, chotra, joining yoke, twin double. These definitions come from Lambden's Coptic grammar. Is Jesus really married in the Gospel of Philip? The Coptic terms partner associate are primarily business and religious terms, respectively. While it's possible for either term to mean spouse, these usages are rare. If the Gospel of Philip was originally written in Syriac, no one thinks it was written in Aramaic, the only Syriac term that allows for the meaning of both partner and spouse is shotofo. This word is rarely applied to the marriage context, but like the Coptic chudra, normally means co-religionist or fellow communicant. Given the theological context, it's most likely that Jesus and Mary are partners in the sense that together they are seen to constitute the mythic primeval androgyny. That sounds far-fetched. That's because we're getting into an area here of Gnostic theology and such that we haven't discussed so far. This would be a development from an early rabbinic view. In Genesis 1, according to this rabbinic view, Adam is originally a male-female combination, made him male and female, etc., androgyne or hermaphrodite, and then in Genesis 2, Adam is then separated into Adam and a male Adam and female Eve when the female Eve is taken out of his side. This primeval androgyny, as pictured in the Gospel of Philip in chapters 68 and 70, as follows. While Eve was still an Adam, death did not exist. When she was separated from him, death came into being. If he enters again and attains his former self, death will be no more. And then in 70, if the woman had not separated from the man, she should not die with the man. His separation became the beginning of death. Because of this, Christ came to repair the separation, which was from the beginning, and again united the two. What about the kiss on the mouth? The kiss on the mouth in the Gospel of Philip is shared among all the enlightened. It's the means of transfusing grace. And we see this remark in the Gospel of Philip, chapter 35. The Logos comes forth from the mouth, because Logos is also the Greek for word, and he who is nourished from the mouth shall become perfect. The perfect are conceived through a kiss, and they are born. Therefore, we also kiss one another to receive conception in our mutual grace. Another concept in the Gospel of Philip is the bridal chamber. The term bridal chamber in Philip appears to be a metaphor for union with God. Gospel of Philip 69 says, "A bridal chamber is not for animals, nor is it for the slaves, nor for defiled women, but is for free men and virgins." And then in Gospel of Philip 81-82, "No one can know when the husband and the wife have intercourse with one another except the two of them." Ideas done in private, huh? "Indeed, marriage in the world is a mystery to those who have taken a wife." Mystery for those who have taken a wife. If there's a hidden quality in the marriage of defilement, that is, physical marriage, how much more is the undefiled marriage a true mystery? It's not fleshly, but pure. It belongs not to desire, but to the will. It belongs not to the darkness, but to the day and the light. However, the bridal chamber may not be quite so metaphorical as some suggested, or as Philip seems to say. Irenaeus, writing about 180 AD, on the basis of reports from women who had followed Valentinian Gnostic teaching, but then repented and returned to the church, notes that they had been led astray into sexual intercourse by these teachers. We don't know whether that was connected with their teaching about the bridal chamber or not. Well, that's a quick tour of these Gospels. Conclusions, were there really 80 Gospels considered for the New Testament? Answer, no. Are the Nag Hammadi and Dead Sea texts really the earliest Christian records? Answer, no. The Dead Sea texts aren't Christian at all. The Nag Hammadi materials are Gnostic and come after several centuries of material that we have from early church fathers, and certainly long after the canonical Gospels. Do the Nag Hammadi and other non-canonical accounts of Jesus really emphasize his humanity? Answer, no. The Nag Hammadi and particularly other Gnostic accounts of Jesus tend to downplay his humanity. Is Philip really married in the Gospel? Is Jesus really married in the Gospel of Thought? Our response, unlikely. Is it true that the non-canonical Gospels and similar records do not match up with the Gospels in the Bible? Answer, yes, but so much the worse for the non-canonical Gospels. And the point we would make here, which we make here on our closing picture, closing screen, is that the other Gospels, in fact, proclaim another Gospel. Well, that's our tour of a goodly number of the other Gospels, and particularly the ones used by Dan Brown, and they suggest rather strongly that these really do not have warrant to be viewed as authentic, as giving us the real picture of who Jesus is and what he did.